So I'm going to start where Gavin left off where he began when he derived the barotropic quasi-geostrophic equations, which can be derived in many ways. I keep finding people deriving these equations in many ways, and I'm going to be talking about deriving barotropic QG when it's a fast singular limit. So I'm going to be looking at the method of multiple scales in time. When Gavin derived these, this is just another way of looking at it. He was looking at asymptotic expansions, I think, in large and small, weren't you? Or you just did an ordinary perturbation?
Yes, yeah, so small Rossby infinity number.
Right, right. I think you used an ordinary perturbation expansion, which is perfectly wonderful. Leslie Smith has a derivation of barotropic QG where she does a Fourier decomposition of the entire set of equations and then only includes modes that do not have any resonances with waves, and she gets it out easily too. So what I'm hoping though to do is talk, just do the high points of the derivation of barotropic QG, I mean just a sketch, but also talk about, there's a second limit to the shallow water equations, a second slow limit. I'm going to call these slow limits. And one is for Rossby number order 1, and for Froude going to 0. So theta in my non-dimensionalization has to do with how flat the surface is getting. Well, it's more like the ratio of the height. It's the height versus the Froude number. But this limit has been studied at length, you know, for the last 30 years by mathematicians looking at the limit of incompressible flow, you know, looking at Euler's equations and things like this. And the reason I think this is interesting for this audience is that when I've just started to look at some MHD things with Steve and Joanne Mason, and what I see in there is something more like this limit, in that there are slow waves, I'm going to say slow means order 1 versus a small parameter epsilon, so this I'm not going to be thinking about things that are potential vorticity and waves, I'm thinking about things that are leading order in some type of asymptotic expansion. So I believe that the kind of cases that I've seen here in terms of MHD and plasma physics, where you're looking for something slow, aren't things that sort of have only a potential vorticity, but have a leading order slow dynamics, more like this one. So I'm making an analogy between subjects that have a wider range of physics than just GFD. So I'm starting with these equations. I'm just going to show you the form, the abstract form of the equations in both these limits. And I have the details of the limit here. And there are many ways you can do this. It's not so important to pay attention, except to know that the 1, quasi-geostrophy, is for rotation and Froude number going to 0 at the same, or at the rate of square root b. And this is what leads to the barotropic QG equation. And the incompressible limit is only for Froude, and this theta, you can relate theta to Froude. It's just a more general case, which if you look at the literature I'm going to be citing, this is how they'll do it, so I'm doing it like that. But so you can see what I've done. So U now contains the horizontal velocity and the free surface. This is a vector that includes all of the unknowns. And you can write it as a local time derivative, a linear operator, and a nonlinear term. And this linear operator contains a small parameter that's getting smaller and smaller. The difference between QG and the incompressible limit is that there is another linear term, which for our case would be the rotation, which is not part of this operator, which multiplies the small parameter. And
clarify, but
sure.
Your parameter B there is that's a Berger number or something.
Yeah, it's something like that. This is the notation of Emmett and Mida and those guys. It is not standard GFD notation. But I thought it would be better if you saw it than just had it in the papers. So I'm just going to talk about the oscillations in these equations. It's that linear term that multiplies a small parameter that gives rise to fast oscillations. The smaller that parameter is, the faster those oscillations are. Now, you don't confuse this with a linear solution, because I'm going to be thinking of the full nonlinearity. But I want you to look at it this way for a minute. If you take that entire vector and you use this mapping, this is like a transformation of variables, but it's basically a linear propagator, or it's a matrix exponential, and you just substitute that in, into these equations, where L is either LQG or L crude, and you differentiate that, what you see is you transform this one equation into this plus another equation, which is for the evolution of the nonlinearity. And people, this is one of the roots of exponential integrators, if you know anything about that. So people have known about this for many years, but I'm touching on it to bring you up to this asymptotic theory that I'm thinking about. So this at first glance, what it looks like you've done is sort of factor out the oscillations from the solution, and that V would be smoother than U. So U, the equation for U, had a 1 over epsilon, and the equation for V does not. However, if you take the second derivative of it, you see that there are still some oscillations in it. So this has limitations, I suppose. So now we come to the idea of the method of multiple scales, which is used widely. I'm just talking about the method of multiple time scales.
Sorry, can I take you back to the previous one?
Yes.
You talk about getting rid of the oscillations. Those don't look like oscillations to me. They're exponential decay. So what would you mean?
So it's not exponential decay. This is a matrix exponential. So it's a vector composed of the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the linear operator.
Oh, that's an operator.
It's an operator.
Imaginary, it's complex.
Yes. And that's represented in here by the L. Okay. So this has been used for many years, before I was born even. And one of the key things that one must do to have an approximation like this that's valid is to show that this term is not as big as this term. So there's many ways to do this, but I'm going to use this one by Kleinerman and Mida, Choquette and the others. This Choquette paper in 1994 was the first paper I know of that took the method of multiple scales onto a solid mathematical foundation, in which if you were to turn the Choquette crank, you would get the equations that did not have secular terms. So this didn't have anything to do with the intuition of physics in this context. This had to do with the nature of the linear operator. So the linear operator itself would need to be skew Hermitian, which from the physics point of view means it has oscillations and not some kind of continuous spectrum. Although that's not a limitation, people have worked on that. But for the sake of this discussion, I just want to talk about the Choquette stuff. So what you do is you find to leading order. Now I'm going to be talking about sort of a formal way of looking at this, but this is the formal reasoning behind the mathematics, which I won't get into, but you'll see the points of how this works. So here is the matrix, this is the operator again, and then you can solve for the order one solution and you get something that looks like this. And then you can solve this equation using Duhamel's formula, And what you can show is that for there to be no secularity, this U bar, so there is a U bar. Now, I just showed you this trick of factoring out the fast waves. It's not getting rid of them, it's factoring them out. When I showed you breaking the problem into U, and I had a V. So in this way of thinking, there is no V. There is a U bar. It is an asymptotic solution. And the U bar is described by this equation. And this is a limit. You know, this parameter tau is connected to the epsilon. And when you take epsilon to zero, this limit has to go to infinity. And this is where Choquette made this big mathematical breakthrough showing that those secondary fast oscillations cancel out when you integrate over time. And this is called the method of cancellation of oscillations. And with this... Sure.
The U bar is smooth. Is that the idea?
Yes. It's smooth. It's integrated...
Are they trouble with the exponential of the L? Because... If L's complex, as it will be, surely, for oscillations,
yes.
Once you start working out the nonlinear terms, what does that nonlinear N mean? I mean, you can... I don't see why... Shouldn't there be sort of an E to the S minus SL and an E to the minus SL star or something? So some of the two.
So you will have this, right? This is a plus. The minuses are in here, right? Remember, these are operators. So they're inverses of operators.
I'm just thinking of a sine or a cosine. It's something plus its complex conjugate. So shouldn't that be exhibited in the L?
So I think that it is. If you substitute in all these operators in terms of the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions of the matrices, you'll see where that is.
I mean, a sine or a cosine isn't an exponential. It's a sum of exponentials.
Yeah, I think so. If you let me, Andrew, just go on. I believe that this is a detail you will see.
I see when the tau goes to infinity, all the oscillating terms just die.
Yeah.
You see, it's this limit of tau going to infinity is what actually takes care of oscillating terms. They disappear in this limit.
When, right.
Because you take integral, right?
I think
I'm not bothered by it. You multiply a sign by two signs together, you get a sine squared, but it's not an e to the x. It's an e to the x, e to the ix. It's an e to the ix plus e to the minus ix.
Yeah, all those terms will disappear. What only the left here will be tau independent and would not have any oscillations. So it's just because you define this limit, tau goes to infinity.
Yes, and this is not zero. This is not zero either. What you do if you substitute in for all, you know, you expand in the normal modes of the system, what you'll find is a relationship C that includes all the three-way resonances from the nonlinear operator. Now this is where we start. I wanted to mention this is the foundation for this locally asymptotic parallel and time numerical method that I've been working on. This is just for people who are interested in numerics, and I didn't want to forget to say it, but this C that comes when you substitute things into, when you substitute the Fourier decomposition into that equation that I just showed you, what you find is because of the nature of this cancellation of oscillations, the leading order solution is composed of slow and fast. It is not, the slow solution is not independent of the fast, making the barotropic QG equations in this, from this point of view, a fast singular limit. And giving it a name like that is probably meaningless, but the key is there's still something very interesting happens. The slow modes, you can show, evolve independently of the fast. So when you start using this integral over all time, what you find is that there are no resonance is allowed between fast, slow. However, you may also find, so in the case of quasi-geostrophy, and this is for initial data that has fast waves in it, the quasi-geostrophic limit, the gravity waves have this really interesting resonance sort of way to describe it in terms of resonances of the gravity waves with the slow modes happens in shells only. So not all of the fast, those go to zero too.
Can I just ask back? When you said the medium order solution is composed of slow and fast.
Yes.
And slow is that for both of your models?
Or yes.
For both?
Yes.
And then you're saying the second statement is just true of
This is just for QG, and I've mentioned this to differentiate it between this point of view of quasi-geostrophy and other ways of deriving it. You know, this includes an extra detail, I suppose.
Both those limits have both slow and fast.
Precisely.
And in both cases.
That's right. But if you were to say, do a numerical solution that had initial data that had slow and fast, and you took measurements of the slow stuff, it would evolve just like this leading order, the barotropic QG. Yes?
You said that the slow modes evolve independently of the fast ones. Does this depend on the fact that the linear operators are skewed Hermitian?
It does indeed, very strongly.
So if it has a continuous spectrum, then...
So people have worked on the continuous spectrum, including Zeitlin and I think maybe Roger Grimshaw. I can't think right offhand, but more mathematicians like Xiaoming Wang and those guys. So they have addressed things that have continuous spectrum in them. So it's more if we stick to skew Hermitian here, you can see the main points of slow and fast. I mean, I guess the bottom line of the continuous spectrum is that something happens at first, but as time goes to infinity, it gets sort of washed out, or at least in the cases that I've looked at. So now that was in order to connect you to the derivation that Gavin showed you, and to tell you what happens when there are two time scales involved, but one of the things that I'm working on, which I think is interesting, you know, Steve told me, you know, discussion, is I'm going to show you some recent work of mine on understanding what happens when this parameter does not go to zero in the real atmosphere and ocean. The rotation does not go to zero. In fact, some people argue it's not that small, maybe 0.1. And the Froude number in the ocean, for example, in the deep Arctic, can be not strong at all. It's strong in most of the ocean, but basically these parameters vary. So what happens when these parameters are small? So here, these are the incompressible, you know, Boussinesq equations. I've solved for the pressure by taking the divergence of momentum. And you can see, just like I showed you before, there are two linear operators, each multiplying potentially small parameters. There's a nonlinear term. You know, here's effects geostrophic balance and hydrostatic balance, and here's what the nonlinearity looks like. And I have dissipation in here, but I'm going to drop it very quickly. But it's in the same form that I've shown you. And the way in this framework, one way that you can derive equations for the slow solution. And by slow, I continue to mean not just potential vorticity, but the leading order dynamics, which in the case of the incompressible limit includes slow waves on the order of the rotation. What you do is you project the unknowns and the equations themselves onto the null space of the fast operator. And that's all I'm going to say about it, but I'm going to be using the projection operator itself in just a second. So I was looking at different limits of the full 3D equations. And what I'm about to do is I use the projection operator to rewrite the equations in terms of their leading order dynamics and everything else. And these are what the projection operators look like. And you don't really need to know the details of these except to understand that if I take this projection operator and apply it to the full dynamics of the simulations I have, I'm getting the component of whatever that is instantaneously on the slow space. So I'm keeping track of what's slow in the general solution and what's not. And well, you do it from the linear operator. You know, you can find the perp and the parallel. So so this particular one. So these papers of Maida and Kleinerman and so forth were like in the 90s, and they never published this projection operator. And once I saw what it looked like, I could see why. It would take up several pages. So my Jared Whitehead, who computed this, he's now an assistant professor. He was my postdoc. He's now an assistant professor at BYU. He did it all in FOIA. He went to FOIA and came back. I thought this was very interesting, too, because as many of you know, quasi-geostrophe is this beautiful mathematical moment when all of the unknowns collapses to the evolution of a scalar. And yet this acts on momentum and buoyancy, and it is the most complicated function. I mean, in some ways, you're in that limit, you are getting to this much more complicated and simple, I guess. So I'm just going to show you a few results, and I'm going to show you for the case of infinite, you know, Rossby to zero stratification order one. And I'm doing this because I feel this is more like the cases I've seen in MHD, maybe plasmas. And so I'm just going to show you the dependency of, so this is triply periodic, random white noise forcing, and I just have the dependence as we you know, have the 1 over Rossby number getting bigger and bigger here. This Q is the potential entropy. This is the slow that I compute using the projection operators to the total. This is the energy, slow to total. And you can see when it starts getting smaller, it's asymptoting to 1 like it should. The energy should be all slow or all fast. I told you I was going to look at what is the if you break all the unknowns up into its projected solution, so everything order 1 and, you know, the order 1 piece and everything else like that, I'm going to show you the strong rotation case. So these are so complicated, but all you have to notice is that all this on the left-hand side is the slow dynamics derived from the asymptotic theory, and everything on the right are sort of terms that couple them, and immediately you can look at the energy type and potential entropy, but I'm just going to look at energy. You can see slow on the left, everything else on the right, and these are all coupling terms under the integrals. And just for the GFD people in the audience, this is what QG looks like. And I have outlined the terms that have exchange between potential and kinetic energy. This is the thing that people are most familiar with. And these are just details of the calculation. So I'm going to show you, this is the horizontal kinetic energy, which is a slow quantity in the for this limit, Rossby to zero, stratification order 1. And I've done it for different Rossby numbers. They're getting smaller and smaller as we go along. And this, the dashed line, is the total energy, and the solid line is the slow stuff. And you can see that even as time evolves, it's almost slow, even for parameters that aren't close to zero. However, the forcing in these cases, you know, this is random white noise forcing, which isn't slow. So the forcing itself is creating the slow structures as we go along. And
sorry, just to get things straight, so you're doing full simulation.
Full simulation.
And then you find the evolution of the slow by each time step.
Projecting it onto the slow, right. That's right. And I think this is the last slide I'm going to show you, but I'm showing you this is the exchange term between the horizontal kinetic and the primes, which is everything else. And you can see that for finite Rossby numbers, you're getting a lot of exchange between, I don't want to call it fast because it's some combination in these limits where I'm not going to zero, but and in fact, it's easy to find an energy pathway. So what this means is that in these cases that we're looking at with this particular kind of white noise forcing, the fast scales or the non-slow scales are actually creating, they're being created. In some cases, they are being created from the slow structure, and they are contributing to the creation of it. So that's the last slide I was going to show. It's just an AltaSpark discussion.
Okay, so we have to thank you back. We have about a quarter of an hour, so that's session to be fun. About 15 minutes for discussion.
Can I ask about your barotropic models?
Yes.
They radiate sound waves.
They do.
They will take energy out of the surface waves and radiate the infinity. And they're supposed to be maintained by what means to be maintained.
So, the barotropic QG case.
Yes.
Okay, so that in that case, this all has to do with resonance, and they didn't put a forcing in.
But it's just sound waves being radiated from the surface to a deep ocean.
So are you talking about shallow water? So no, it's all horizontal.
It's actually mainly deep water, in fact.
So I showed you two cases, the barotropic, you said?
Yes,
barotropic?
I'm talking about barotropic, yeah.
So in barotropic, there's only horizontal distribution?
Only horizontal, what does that mean?
So in the case that I showed you for barotropic QG, there is only allowed horizontal, well, there's the vertical surface.
Yeah, the vertical surface grooves, therefore they get sound waves.
But always horizontally. Because there's only in the barotropic case, but there's only a depth, so only this can oscillate. It can't propagate down at all. I mean, the surface will depress, but it's a two-dimensional quantity itself.
In a deep ocean, that is infinitely far. Are you saying they can the radiation comes back again?
No, I'm not saying anything about the propagation of waves in the deep ocean.
That's not what I'm saying. So, you know, surface disturbance will radiate sound waves, take energy from the system.
Yes.
So that, if you don't do anything at all, that will damp the surface wave systematically. And in the deep ocean, that will make the ocean flat, by that time.
So, you know, the case that you've described, if I understand it, has a boundary layer in the top layer, too, that's doing things. I mean, I guess I don't understand what you're saying. But in these cases that I'm studying here are far too simple to draw conclusions about the deep ocean. In the barotropic case that I showed you, it was talking about the horizontal propagation of energy. And in the triply periodic case that I was showing you, the main things that can be deduced are things about transformation of energy. So I don't think I can say...
Yeah, the normal horizontal propagation of energy that you have in compressible flow, that's not the point. The point is that once you disturb the ocean in the compressible fluid, it will radiate sound waves and take energy away from you and spread it to the surface.
I agree with that.
Well, isn't that a serious consideration for the barotropic model?
It could be. You know, I don't feel like I'm comfortable deducing something about finite limits here. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I'm doing these studies.
Well, I'm not arguing against the incompressible case. I'm just saying that the compressible case seems to be a lot of trouble.
The incompressible case.
The compressible case.
So the shallow water case.
No, not shallow water. No, not the shallow water. Take an infinitely deep ocean.
Yes.
It will radiate, it will adapt the surface disturbance by radiating. But doesn't that worry you? What you're doing? I mean, okay, you're doing a finite ocean. What happens to the energy you're radiating down?
When you say things like that, I imagine all kinds of complex things. I mean, the ocean itself is filled with eddies, even the deep ocean.
Very complex too. I'm not talking about mathematics, I'm talking about physics.
I'm saying what you say to me, I imagine these waves radiating down through, in the real ocean, eddies propagating through the deep ocean, you know, in the deep Arctic. They've discovered these eddies that fill up the entire depth of the ocean. Then there are these, you know, as was discussed in the conference, there are these interesting layers, the double diffusive layer. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on.
These are well modeled by incompressible fluids, and I'm not arguing about this, I'm talking about compressible fluids. And you talked about magnetic field theory as a serious consideration. If you have a magnetic field theory conducting the ocean vertically, it has a vertical component, it radiates alpha in waves.
Yes.
Yes,
I am in complete agreement with that. What do you see that is not...
I think that you started off by presenting two models, one barotropic and one incompressible.
Right.
I'm not arguing with the second, I'm taking the first one as serious problem.
I completely agree with you about that. I didn't get to show you the quasi-geostrophic case of the triply periodic stuff I was doing with the full, but this is incompressible.
Yes.
Even in those cases, there are complex things going on between things that are QG and not QG.
Yes, I'm not arguing about that. I only argue about the barotropic, the compressible case. I think it's completely different.
Yes. I actually think we're in agreement. But I keep going to the real ocean. Well, maybe.
Okay, so I think I've
kind of in relation to this, so I'm interested in subsonic flows, and I've been trying to solve the fully compressible equations in the very low Mach number limit, and seeing what the sound waves do, and certain numerical experiments that I've done show that the sound waves in some cases have absolutely no influence. So the fact that you're radiating sound waves and then they damp, it doesn't actually influence things as long as things are low Mach number.
Well,
this is a compressible fluid.
Yeah.
But the fluid is moving fairly slowly, and then the sound waves basically decouple and don't influence the slow dynamics.
I think that sounds right to me too.
Yeah, you're having sound waves on what time scales? Mm-hmm.
Yes, the time scale is very limited, and maybe it's okay, but in general, it's not something to worry about. And then it's you say, you've got to worry about radiation alpha and radiation the perfectly conducting fluid goes to infinity, take energy with it.
Yes.
So Beth, the idea that you can take a Froude number and Rossby number to zero independently in this kind of flow,
mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously you can construct a forcing with it, where that's possible, in turbulent simulations, say.
Right.
But I suppose what you must be doing then is you're controlling the aspect ratio of, say, PV structures that appear in the flow when you do that. So you're forcing columns, I suppose, if you're...
You mean, are you talking about the incompressible
case? In your simulations where you're trying to simulate a situation where the Froude number is small and the Rossby number is order one.
So. Okay. So none of this has to do with the aspect ratio. That's one of the key things about it. This has to do with uncovering the physics that's going on, not forcing it to fit into some box. Right.
Yeah, but the aspect ratio of the PV structures that appear in the flow that you're creating would have to have an aspect ratio which is greater than n over f or whatever the.
Yes.
But in real geophysical flows, including decaying turbulence in the boost and s equations,
right.
The aspect ratio always automatically goes to order one. I mean, there's lots of experiments by Dritzschel and people that show that.
Yep.
So in a sense, the QG distinguished limit is the only really relevant limit to...
Yeah, so I don't agree with that anymore. I mean, I think if you were looking for the QG balance, as in my simulations, you will find it everywhere. And you will not know what is being converted to it and taken away from it. You will find... If I stick measurements in my simulations, even with these aspect ratios, I find the slow dynamics. It's how the
you're interested just in the exchange of energy between slow and fast dynamics.
Yes, and you know this work of Jacques Van Ness too, where he showed that you could have spontaneous creation of fast dynamics. I actually think fast is a bad word anymore. There is a spontaneous generation of waves, right? This gets back to light hill radiation. Exponentially small, however, he wasn't thinking of it this way. You know, and so I can actually see these things coming on. If you can set up an experiment too to keep you in that framework. You know, you can do it, that's for sure. But I think when Rossby and Froude either do not go to zero or they do not go to zero at the same rate, then you are opening the door for transfers of things into the slow space and fast space.
Oh yeah, nobody would question that there are transfers. What I was questioning is whether the model where thinking about the model where the Froude number goes to zero, where the Rossby number is relevant to any.
So in the cases I did, the Rossby number wasn't large, it was just order one,
yeah,
right? So there are engineering things where that's available, or you can, even this incompressible limit, you can take out the rotation entirely, it's not a geophysical flow at all, but you can look at what happens in the flat top limit. And for these other cases too, for example, when you have Froude order one and Rossby small, that case applies to the deep Arctic, where there's almost no you know, it's vertically for 3,000 meters, there's no stratification, and it supports these columns that are, they're not predicted by the theory, but the slow equations for that limit goes to 2D Navier-Stokes that has the creation of columns in it as well. So I think that the real geophysical case, you know, and my colleagues who do numerical stuff in the atmosphere tell me that the separation of time scales in the atmosphere, if it's incompressible, is 0.1. It isn't 0.0001. If it's 0.1 like they tell me, and I don't know as much about the atmosphere, but that is leaving a big window open for things to be exchanged. And
The other question I would have is that, I mean, there's been a lot of work by McIntyre and others about how to define a slow manifold or a fuzzy manifold.
Right.
And if you do something like that in the shallow water equation, say, and follow the procedures that is set out to define a higher order balance model,
right.
You actually see very little exchange in that framework between gravity waves and
Right.
Even up to very high Froude numbers. So I'm wondering maybe if your method of separating between fast and slow modes is actually not, might be overestimating exchanges because you're not using a balance that is accurate in that sense?
Well, so the other two limits that include slow waves are not, in some ways you can think of those, of the Froude, in the three-dimensional case, you can think of Froude to zero, Rossby order one, and the other case as cases when the deformation radius goes to zero or infinity. Okay, so so a lot of these things, are assuming things that they're looking for in some sense too. The asymptotic expansions that include higher order terms, they're still assuming that Rossby and Froude are sort of going to zero at the same rate and things like this. There's another paper that Jared Whitehead and I and Terry Hout have submitted to nonlinearity, which shows the asymptotics when you have two parameters and they're going to zero at different rates, so they're getting smaller at different rates. You can actually see in this cancellation of oscillations argument that you are going to have exchange terms, and if the one isn't faster than the other, it kind of is interfering with the balance too. So you aren't to think, Gavin, that I think all this stuff is wrong. It's more that I think that from this point of view, when you don't think of it as only potential vorticity, you think of something as slow as a greater space than just potential vorticity, you will find different things.
Yeah, because, so I want to be pragmatic. You mentioned that this technique, the advantage I see from a numerical point of view is the fact of being able to do this parallel time.
Yeah.
I wanted to have an idea when you show the previous slide, when you show the growth of the slow. You have a discrepancy with the total value.
Yep.
So do you understand that this is a fast dynamic that you are missing? So my question is, if you are time stepping using your method, is it faster than the Fourier version? If it's faster, then it's good. If it's not, then
you mean
using this projection operator is costly. So how costly is it?
So the parallel in time thing does not use the projection operator at all. People have tried to use, this is another thing, Gavin, people have tried to use this parallel in time method using a slow, the way this works is you take big time steps using something slow.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you break the big time steps into many intervals, and on each one of these intervals you do them all at once. And it gives you extra parallelism if this works. But things like GFD have never worked for that because slow dynamics doesn't work. You can't converge the solution. If you use quasi-geostrophy for the slow guess, you can't get the right answer. I mean, I'll show you.
That's probably the key question.
I'll just say one thing. The trick for parallel in time is that this does not go to infinity. This goes to what the locally small parameter is. So you locally time average in a parallel way. So if you imagine your oscillations, you just integrate over a few oscillations to take a big time step. And this way you're getting the slow stuff as it evolves.
Does it in practice gain you some time? You at the end?
Yeah.
I mean, the question is a silly, very nice question. At the end, do you get to evolve your system faster?
So for the shallow water equations with varying parameters for the QG limit, we find a factor of 100 over, in time parallelism only, over conventional methods. And I haven't included, there's also a parallel, super parallel way to do the exponential operator that it'll be even faster than. Yeah.
Thank you, Dad.
Yeah, you're welcome. Does Andrew need a microphone?
Yeah.
Yes.
You will put the slide on the wiki or somewhere?
Yeah.
these talks being recorded are on
slide. He says 4 inches.
What do you do? How do you do it?
That goes in your pocket.
What do you write with? Oh, it's there. Right, this is, I didn't know what to talk about to start with. This is going to be classical fluid dynamics, and taking you back a long way to Couette flow. And what we're going to do is look at a modification of Couette flow that's considered from time to time. Spherical Couette flow. So the idea is you have two concentric spheres and you rotate them about common axis. The outer one, say, is rotating with angular velocity omega 2. The inner one's rotating with angular velocity omega 1. They have different radii, R2 and R1. And the object of the exercise is to rotate the inner one faster than the outer one. And there's a situation in which instability sets in. In the basic state, there is a secondary motion, which consists of a sort of meridional circulation, which is not of key importance, but it's something you need to be aware of. So you could have these two giant cells. But the object of the exercise is really to look at the instability, which sets in near the equator, because the angular velocity, the angular momentum effects are biggest there, and the behavior locally there is somewhat similar to the classical cylindrical Couette flow problem, where you rotate two cylinders, and what happens is that Taylor vortices appear, and what we're going to do is look in the narrow gap limit in which eps, the small parameter, is R2 minus R1 over R1. And when that's small, you expect the onset of instability to be localized near the equator here and to resemble what it would look like in between parallel cylinders. So you get these, you're expecting small scale eddies in this region. And because the gap is small, as you move away from the equator, the belief is that the amplitude sort of goes to zero. Now, I suppose, if I understand it correctly, the reason that there was interest in this originally was in the hope that it would dispel the problem of end effects in experiments where this has finite length, and that because the vortices would be confined locally, that this would be an experimentally more amenable configuration.
So, Alejandro, can you recall us a criteria? Is it the Rayleigh criteria for the instability?
No, because this is viscous.
So what's the instability criteria? Can you write
okay, it? We need some more parameters. There's a second parameter, the angular momentum ratio, which is R1 squared omega 1 minus R2 squared omega 2 divided by the sum . So there's the angular momentum ratio. Clearly this needs to be greater than 1 in order for the angular momentum at the inside to be greater than the outside. There's a Taylor number. The Taylor number that's used in this context is commonly 1 over epsilon delta R1 squared R1 squared omega 1 minus R2 squared omega 2 divided by nu. That's just an angle, that's a Taylor number. It's a bit like an Ekman number, square of an Ekman, inverse square of an Ekman number. And then the, what do we need? That's the Taylor number. Oh gosh, I've got this the wrong way around, sorry. Let me just, that's the Reynolds number. Rm is epsilon squared times that. That's the Reynolds number, and the Taylor number is 1 over, is well, essentially proportional to 1 over epsilon delta Rm squared. So the driving quantity is the Taylor number. The Taylor number's got to reach a sufficient size before instability sets in. Okay. Now, we've got a number of parameters here. The crucial one on which most hinges is the fact that epsilon is small. Epsilon essentially defines the length scale. These are sort of more or less square cells, so the length scale, sort of north-south, if you like, is defined by epsilon. The angular momentum parameter comes in a way which isn't immediately obvious at this stage, so let's just bear in mind that it's another parameter. Crucially, the object of any stability analysis would be to find the critical Taylor number. Then you'd look for, that would be the linear theory. You would then go to the finite amplitude situation and ask what happens next. Now, the way one can analyze this is, well, it's sort of roughly along an elementary form of the stuff Beth was talking about. You have a an exponential wave type dependence, e to the I integral epsilon to the minus 1 k d theta minus omega t. You have an amplitude dependence like that. So you have these vortices are essentially described by that part. You've then got a radial structure, which is determined as part of the eigenvalue problem. And then you ask the object, the whole object here is to get the amplitude modulation A of theta of t of these vortices. And you have that plus its convex conjugate. So that's the objective. This in turn leads to, if you put in, make this ansatz, and on the fast time, fast length scale, as it were, all that sort of stuff, you get out a dispersion relation, which determines the frequency as a function of the wave number k, which appears here, the latitude theta. Theta is the latitude. And it'll depend on the parameters delta and t. Of course, epsilon as well, in a sort of hidden sort of way. Right, how are we doing? Basically, what we this is the animal we're after. The onset of instability is can be based on the cylindrical problem, and for that you anticipate that the most unstable modes are going to be located near the equator. They're going to be modulated away from the equator. And the essence of this dispersion relation is that for that problem, you get a critical wave number k corresponding to what's happening at the equator here. You get the critical latitude is the equator, and there is a critical Taylor number. The frequency for these modes is just as it is in the cylindrical problem. The frequency, only critical, is real. So, omega equals omega c. Sorry, and it's naught. And it's naught. That's crucial. But what's important for what follows is that, treated as a dispersion relation, the frequency gradient, well, one of the conditions that's important is that the derivative with respect to k evaluated at critical vanishes. That essentially is the condition that you've minimized the Taylor number, in fact. Right, now, the way we're going to go All that comes from this problem. What we want to do is see what happens for this problem. So what you do is a Taylor series expansion of the dispersion relation. So if you do this, and just keep the lowest order terms, I'll write it this way, the increment of the Taylor number, and I'll put a minus I with it. This is so we can translate it back to time derivatives afterwards. There is various terms. Let me just list them. The first order ones are minus I, omega t, delta t, that's the increment of the Taylor number, minus I omega differential with respect to theta times theta, a minus a half omega I omega theta theta times theta squared, plus a half I omega kk I delta k all squared, minus omega k theta theta I delta k. So that's taking them up to second order, plus and so on. Now the point about doing this is if I want to take this back into an amplitude equation, all I have to do is relate that to a time derivative, and that to a space derivative, bearing in mind the location of the epsilon there. So the minus I omega I delta omega can translate to a time scale derivative, and the I delta k translates to a epsilon d by d theta quantity. So if you wrote out the amplitude equation for A, just by doing this, you've got a dA by dt plus an epsilon, this is from the term way over to the right, epsilon omega k theta dA by d theta equals minus I omega t delta t minus I omega theta theta minus I omega theta 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 squared times A. One more important one, this one. Plus half I omega k k epsilon squared d2 a by d theta squared. Right, there's a lot of terms there. And a lot of things going on. Now, what I'd want to draw your attention to are the crucial things. This one amounts to the thing that drives it. It's the excess Taylor number, so that's the driving term. You have what you might call diffusive damping. Right, what else? This is a group velocity term. I think I've missed something. Omega k theta, there's a theta in there. That theta goes with that theta. This is relevant, but not that relevant. It corresponds to a variable group velocity, and we will ignore this term. It's a high order term which isn't of consequence to us. So the leading order contribution balances are that, that, and that. Now, it's at this point I should emphasize the way classically these problems usually go. Classically, you don't have this term. And you have what might be called a sort of phase damping term. And if you consider that balance, you've got absolutely no problem in finding steady solution. You've just got a Gaussian, it's parabolic cylinder function equation, balancing those three terms up. Forgetting that, just you've got a steady solution which would give you a Gaussian, and we give you a solution which was sort of localized near the equator. No problem with that at all. The problem comes with this term. That's the one that gives you a lot of trouble. The omega
That bit, the omega theta is real. Now, how are we doing? What have I got to stop?
12.
12, right.
That's assuming that there's some discussion.
That's a challenge, isn't it? That there'll be some discussion. Right. there are various balances that come up here, because the point is that naturally this is a sort of small amplitude expansion, so the theta is supposed to be small. It's all driven by the... Have I got that epsilon power the right way up? Yeah, that's right. That's an epsilon squared there. So the theta scale here is actually short. It's epsilon to the half. So this term is bigger than that one. That's the cause of all the trouble. This is the biggest term. And you can balance things up in different ways. And I think at this stage, I should draw your attention to the length scale. There's you've got various length scales that come out of this problem. Ooh. You've got the pulse width.
Andrew, is the phase damping term the same
order
as the group
velocity term? Oh, no, this is negligible. No. This one, there's a theta in there, remember. It's small. It is relevant to the broader scheme of things, but it's not relevant to what I'm going to say. The pulse width, theta, Taylor vortex, which is essentially order epsilon. There's I've got them the wrong way. That's vortex width. Vortex width. That length that I sort of suggested up here, well, I said epsilon to the half. Now, that's on the basis that you are balancing up this one and this. If you balance up that one and that one, you get a different length scale. And that's what I'm going to call the pulse width. And that's theta p. Yeah, this is nice. It's more relaxing than standing up. Epsilon squared over delta to the 1/3. This is on the basis that delta might be small. The point is that this omega theta is at critical is order delta. So basically, when the angular momentum ratio, when this difference is small, when they're almost co-rotating, that parameter delta is small, and the size of this term goes down. So it's worth keeping track of that. So if delta was small, that would be the length. And if you consider the balance, the other balances, you get another length, A, B, C. There's an unstable domain. That comes about, provided this number is bigger than that number, the thing is the driving, as long as driving less phase damping is greater than naught, you've got essentially a locally unstable region. So you can first of all demand that those two balance. You can also demand that diffusion also balances the driving. Doing those together, you get an estimate for delta T, and you get delta T to the half is the same size as the unstable angle, and that unstable angle then, when you've done all those balances I mentioned, turns out to be Excellent. Over. Well, no, all we need is order. Epsilon delta to the 1/3. And the reason I mention all this is because if you now look at the various length scales that arise, if you look at those, you can sort of draw a log-log plot of minus log of theta versus minus log of delta. And you can get various scales. There's the vortex scale, minus log epsilon, which that's the line here, that's minus log of theta Taylor vortex, it's just a constant. Then the other ones, when this goes to zero, you get the epsilon to the half scale, and that's the minus a half log epsilon. So when delta is order epsilon to the half, that's the situation in that one, and that are all, everything's the same size. And at that limit, the unstable width and the pulse width merge at that value. However, as you increase delta to 1, 1 being the case when the inner sphere, the outer sphere doesn't rotate, these various other ratios go up and down. So there's the minus log of theta p, and there's a minus log of the unstable region. And they reach this minus 2/3 log epsilon and minus 1/3 log epsilon. So if you would think of the Taylor cylinder problem, you'd be thinking more in terms, well, cylinder problem isn't the right word. If you didn't have that term, then the pulse and the unstable would be the same size. But as you increase as you decrease the angular velocity of the outer sphere, they actually diverge. So you have a Taylor vortex length scale, you then have a length scale of a pulse, and then the unstable region is even longer. So you've got three length scales. Now, where I want to go, and we need to sort of skim a bit here, but we now want to look at the amplitude equations in more detail. The first thing to notice, the thing that's causing all the trouble is this term. So let's just look at the balance under symmetrical scaling. dA by dt equals lambda plus Ixa. That has a solution, A proportional to e to the I lambda plus x lambda plus xt. And this is very important because it's the whole nature of this problem pivots around this xt. If you were to put dissipation in and add in the extra term d2a by dx squared, you can still play the same sort of game and look for a solution, a proportional to an amplitude t e to the I xt. You can play the same game, but then A, this big A, we'll skip the details, tends to zero as t goes to infinity, so that's not very helpful. You can put in the phase damping. You can write this as dA by dt equals lambda plus Ix minus, it's easy to do with that symbol in LaTeX, but I can't write it myself. It's an epsilon, x squared a plus d2a by dx squared. That solution you can solve as well, no particular problem there. It's got an a, which is e to the minus a half x minus I over 2 epsilon squared to the 3 halves all squared, and the x is epsilon to the half x. Now, and the eigenvalue for this problem, lambda, is epsilon plus 1 over 4 epsilon squared. Now, the point I want to draw your attention to is under, this is a scale theta. And for general values of delta 1, for example, epsilon would be minute. It's only order 1 when you're in that left-hand limit. So the normal situation is that this is very large under the scaling. It's going off as sort of, it's very large. So this lambda is very large. And in fact, when you're in, you basically go out of the limit in which the solution is valid, unless you're extremely careful. So there are a number of things that come out of this. The critical Taylor number is shifted up above the Taylor vortex one by an amount which actually is order delta squared, if you go to small delta. So the delta critical, T critical, according to this theory, is the Taylor vortex critical plus something order delta squared. In other words, if delta is order 1, the local theory doesn't work. Now, you can put in the term Stewart Landau term and put in from the Taylor vortex problem an extra term minus, I suppose it is, some constant determined by the Taylor vortex problem times mod a squared a. Now you have a different situation, and you can look at this problem with that term included, minus mod a squared a. And the story now starts to get interesting. Because if you look at the plot of amplitude versus Taylor number, what you get is this following sort of thing, situation. You've got your Taylor vortex critical. You've got another TC, which is the one we're talking about down here. And from that, you get very, very, well, provided that, yeah, provided delta is small, but not too small. Well, I mean, this is theory is done for these two about the same size, but the ratio of those is, we're thinking of it as being somewhat large. Then you get very small amplitude solutions which come off. Here, these are steady solutions. They're very, very small amplitude, exponential in terms of the delta. These are steady. They suffer, the first one suffers a supercritical hot bifurcation, which goes off. Then it you get a you get two in which there are two vacillating solutions. They merge at a gluing bifurcation, and then they goes backwards. You have a zero mean limit cycle behavior, which comes off at the back here, and everything's unstable, and very much else after that is unstable. But they soon develop sort of reasonably periodic states, and a lot of them, things which are sort of reasonably periodic. And what you see, if you just let the thing zip, because at this stage we've given up trying to trace anything, if you let the thing zip, you see a solution that's beginning to look a bit like this. And you'll notice that it's actually, the smaller you make, the larger you make that ratio, the closer this gets back to here. So you get solutions which are doing this sort of thing. So this, if you like, is the situation as epsilon tends to infinity. If I got it the right way around, oops, the epsilon going to naught, surely. Yeah, epsilon going to naught. So in that limit, you get some sort of nice behavior. And what one would like to do is analyze what's going on. Well, the first thing you'd like to do is drop this term. Because it presumably isn't important on when you've got that far. You can then ask for solutions. Many years ago, and I think to be true to whoever first had a go at this, I guess Leslie Hawking tried this, tried solving that equation, no solution. Setting that equal to naught. Now, what this observation misses is that solutions like that, the hope was that you'd get a nice solution, which was of a sort of a nice pulse-like thing that we mentioned early on. You'd like to get a sort of pulse solution, but you don't get it. Something decaying on both sides. Now, what this doesn't take into account is the fact that there's this pulse width is narrow compared to the domain in which the solutions are unstable. You've got a very wide range of instability. If you had a pulse solution like that, the rest of it would be empty. So why not try and fill it? Well, once you do that, the question is, to note the following property. If you have a solution of this equation, if the, with the time dependence in, there's another one, ax of t, which is e to the I L t, t being a constant here, times a of x minus l t. In other words, it's a translated solution, but with a different frequency. And this suggests looking for a solution of the following type. A x t t equals, going right back to this early idea, e to the I x t, and then a sum of solutions which I'll write as a n of t plus n t e to the I n t x. So you're doing a Fourier transform of x, but simultaneously putting in a frequency there which is continuous in x. So you've got a continuous frequency, if you like, omega continuous in x. So you could try looking for a solution like that. And lo and behold, Andrew Bassam did this, and he just let the thing rip to see what these ANs did. And after judicious choice of Lambert and T, found solutions in which these ANs of T were all of one form. And the mu n's just take on following values. They repeat themselves. Mu n plus 4 is mu n. And the mu n's 1, 0, 1, 2, 3 are 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. So they flick signs in pairs. So, but basically, you only got one amplitude. And you get a periodic solution with this structure. And what you get is if you plot these ANs, is you get sort of things that come up, come down, come up, come down, and then there's two on the other side, come up, come down, and they just repeat themselves like this indefinitely. Now, this is the bit you might be interested in, and that's why I chose this problem, just for the next point. This solution is got a continuous frequency, in a sense, and it's a finite Fourier transform in x. Have I got that right? Nt, there's nothing there, I've rubbed it out. Finite Fourier transform in x. But the idea is, You can use transform methods and transform this. Use a Fourier integrals. You can rewrite this solution in the following form: A x t as a function of L. L is actually going to be simply LT is going to be pi. They're related. And what you get is a solution with two sums. And the two sums really come from the plus one and minus one, minus one. One is e to the I pi upon 4 sum over all n. This is minus infinity to plus infinity. E to the I 2n plus a half LT, some function, some universal function, a bar, which is, if you like, our pulse, x minus 2n plus a half L, and then the other sum is e to the minus I pi upon 4 sum, and then everything's sort of the same, except there's a minus in the exponential there, that's a minus, and this is a plus. So there's a flick of signs there, 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 and there. But what you've got here is a sum of pulses. And what you've gone from is a situation, it's not a, something missing. No, there isn't. You've gone from a situation where you had Fourier sums in the space coordinate to Fourier sums in the frequency. So you've sort of got a different situation. Now these series interlock, and the solutions you get this way appear to be quite robust. If you were to plot amplitude or energy or something versus x, and what do we need in the other direction? The parameter L, I suppose. Big L. So the solution depends on L or equivalent to big T. There is a value at which these solutions set in of not x, it's lambda. There's a value of lambda at which these solutions first appear. So if you go along in L, there's an amplitude there at which the solution first happens. And then you can sort of essentially get a sort of paraboloid, surface of revolution coming out of there. The solutions themselves, that these solutions just exist on the boundary of this, and then there's a, you can think of a situation like this, where at given lambda there's a whole range of L, the solution's all the way around that loop. But that this thing fills in. We had another student look at this, and we found periodic solutions with more complicated structures appearing inside there. Now, the point about this is that these represent a sort of skeleton about which this finite amplitude behavior can exist. I'm not saying the solution is going to settle on one of these solutions, but rather there's a whole mass of these sorts of solutions, and it can drift from one of them to another without any problem. There's a clearly a well-defined, robust range in which these solutions exist in a sort of quasi-periodic way. They sort of represent a skeleton which forms an attractor, I suppose, you'd say. Now, the point that I thought was interesting is the following, that if you think about these solutions, and you draw x in one direction, divided by the length scale L, and you plot frequency in the other direction, divided by the length scale, that can't be right. Of course it is. You have to divide by L, then that's omega t over pi. So what you're getting is, whereas in the original Fourier representation, nice colour would be useful, whereas you started off by thinking of a continuous solutions with a continuous frequency, we finished up with, rather than a continuous frequency, the dominant part of the solution is now got a fixed frequency. So the frequency locally of your solution actually goes up in the staircase. So the frequency of the solutions you're looking at You can see it. It's clear. You've got well-defined frequencies, and these frequencies correspond to modes localized at those points. So if you move out to x equals n pi upon 2n pi plus half l, the mode is what you see is dominated by that mode with that frequency. So what this seems to suggest is that in some sense, this length, I've rubbed it off now, haven't I? I was trying to keep it. The length scale which we identified for the pulse width length scale, can be thought of as a sort of Rhine scale. It's the scale over which the frequency tries to adjust to, rather than vary continuously like it does on a beta plane, that you have the solution is trying to do is fix on a frequency. So this would also be a manifestation of the mean flow generated. So at these low levels, of course, the mean flow would be fairly wobbly, but you can imagine once you've got this going quite a long way to the right, then the mean flow would also exhibit features similar to what you're seeing here in the frequency. The frequency is adjusting over domains to be of one particular value. There's a region where it wants to take this value, another region where it wants to take that value, and so on. So from that point of view, there seems to be some sort of overlap here in this solution with things people seem to be talking about at this meeting. Thank you.
We have 2 minutes. Have you got any questions or comments? This non-linearity, Andrew, this is a fairly generic non-linearity.
Yeah.
Does it have a coefficient from it?
Well, you can scale it out. Whatever it was, scale it out. I mean, you get it from, I don't know who got that coefficient first. Yeah. Tony David or something?
Yeah.
Tony David do the non-linear term for the cylindrical coax flow? I mean, there's a number that's been worked out.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Let's remind ourselves that we have a paper discussion tomorrow morning at 10:30.